Hello and welcome to Talk Dialogue to Me, produced by Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue. On every episode, we will speak with dialogue practitioners about their inspiring work and find out more about all the incredible things dialogue can do. This is Talk Dialogue to Me.
Hello, and welcome to the Talk Dialogue to Me podcast. This podcast is produced by Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, and it is hosted on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I'm your host, Shari Virgi-Tanyada, Program Coordinator for the Semester in Dialogue here at the SFU Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue. Today I'm here with Mark Winston, who is the founding director of the Center for Dialogue. Dr. Mark L. Winston has had a distinguished career researching, teaching, writing, and commenting on bees and agriculture, environmental issues, and science policy. Mark is Professor Emeritus of Biological Sciences and was the founding director of the Semester in Dialogue from 2002 to 2014, and the Center for Dialogue from 2006 to 2014. In 2020, he joined the SFU Library as the first nonfiction writer in residence. Mark is here to take us back to the basics of dialogue and share some insights he has collected over his life and career in dialogue. We're so excited to have him here. Welcome, Mark.
Great to be here.
Mark, could you give a little bit of a personal history about how dialogue became such a huge part of your life and work?
Well, like most things professionally, it started with the bees. I'm an entomologist. Honeybees are my specialty. And I spent a lot of time with my head inside of a beehive. And when you just slow down and take the time to appreciate a creature like honeybees, it's remarkable how insightful you can be around the complex societies that honeybees exemplify. And I think I began, a lot of my research was about communication, how bees tell each other information through chemicals, through vibrations, through sound, visually. And I began to appreciate the interaction that's involved in communication, which essentially is dialogue. It wasn't too long before I started applying some of the same ideas to people. First in agriculture. There's a lot of very contentious issues in agriculture that I was involved with. And the things that I learned from bees about listening, about collaboration, about complexity, about accepting nuance, about an understanding without judging, they seemed to transfer over pretty well into people. And so I gradually became more and more focused on dialogue with people from what I learned from the bees.
That's fascinating. For those of us who are new to the work of dialogue, or maybe need to go back to the basics, how do you think dialogue stands apart from other forms of conversation or debate? What makes dialogue unique?
Conversation can be fun, but can also be shallow. Debate is very argumentative, and it's about winning. Mm-hmm. Even conversation can be about scoring points. Dialogue is about listening. It's about understanding. It's about accepting the validity of other viewpoints. And it's a completely different space to occupy than the way we often interact with each other, where we are debating with the objective of winning the argument rather than understanding the other side. And it's a profound difference in how we understand and relate to each other.
Mm. So true. I'm thinking of the word dialogue, and the sense that I get is that it is between two people. But in the context of our work at the center, I think that it is often about bringing more than two people to the conversation or to the exercise, if we could call dialogue an exercise.
Oh, very much. It's yes, two people can have a dialogue. And I suppose the word technically refers to an interaction between two people. But in a room full of people, our responsibility in dialogue is to the room, it's to the group. It's to making sure everybody has an opportunity to be heard and everybody has an opportunity to listen. And it's quite symphonic in that way, in that sometimes one voice is louder than others, sometimes there's a chorus of voices, and sometimes it's quiet. And so in that sense, it's a trialogue or fourplexalogue or whatever you want to, decalogue, whatever number you want to put on it. It's a the interaction between two people can very easily and in a healthy way expand to be a conversation among many.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe where dialogue differs, is that people are coming into a group environment with the understanding that voices need to be heard and therefore one needs to be listening. Would you say that that is one of the challenges of making a conversation an effective dialogue?
Well, in just conversations, most of us are not listening intensely to what somebody else is saying. We may be thinking about, you know, what we're going to have for lunch that day. And part of what somebody's saying, you know, in a social setting is going through. Maybe we're looking around for somebody more interesting to talk to. In a debate, we're listening to pick a hole in somebody else's argument. Aha, there's a weak point. I can challenge that and destroy my debating partner. But in dialogue, you're listening purely to understand. It's a deeper, more intimate type of listening. And you're listening not just to the words, but what's the meaning underneath the words? And you're not listening with the sense of, what am I going to say next? You're listening with the sense of, is this the time for me to say something? Is it better to hear someone else talk at this point? I'm not going to try to create points, score points that make me look good. I want to create an environment and maybe contribute sometimes in a way that the conversation in the room is at its best, that everybody benefits. So it's a very different kind of listening. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing I'd say about listening and dialogue is that at its best, you're not judging. You know, in conversation, you know, a friend may make a superficial point, like, hey, you know, what did you think? You know, I thought that was a great movie the other night. And you might be listening in a way that allows you to agree or disagree. In a debate, you're certainly listening with the sense of, I want to win this thing. But in a dialogue, you're not judging. You're, you know, you're not listening and saying, oh, you know, she liked that movie. What a dork she is. How could she possibly like that movie? Or my, you know, my debating colleague over there, he just really uncorked a blooper and I am now going to wipe the floor with him. Mm-hmm. Not like that. That's not real listening. That's listening with an agenda. Dialogue is listening without an agenda.
Mm. So then, is dialogue always the ideal?
Yeah, dialogue is not always the thing to do. You know, it's fun to have a conversation, you know, say, hey, what do you think of the game last night? Or, you know, that was a great movie, or whatever. Those kinds of social conversations, absolutely fine and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Debate, critical in our society around, you know, political policy. It's very important to have arguments. But dialogue is a different way, it's a different way to interact. And it has a place when the objective is to understand. And the objective is to deepen your relationship with someone you're talking to. I would argue that dialogue is actually a better way to get to a good place than debate might be. Because once you build a relationship with someone through dialogue, you're much more likely to work together mutually for a common purpose. Whereas in debate, you're just trying to defeat the other person and win. So, you know, dialogue is not just about understanding with no purpose. It can very much go in a direction that can yield a really good outcome.
Yeah, that's interesting to come at dialogue with an objective of understanding. I think there can always be hidden agendas that people don't know about. And even in a dialogue with a group, you could have joiners who are wanting to upend the conversation or the dialogue to win.
You can only have a dialogue between people who want to do it. If there's one person would really like to understand the other side, and person number two or person number three or ten are all about winning, you can't have a dialogue. People have to come into the room with that intention.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't believe that, no matter how skillful somebody may be at dialogue, I don't believe they could sit in a room with Donald Trump, for example, and have a dialogue. I don't think he would be an individual who would be that interested in getting to know someone else in that way. Mm-hmm. So it really takes everybody in the room to participate. What's really interesting, though, is that if you have a room of 20 people, there might just be two or three or four of them who really get it, really mm-hmm. want to have that kind of discussion. And it's remarkable how quickly people pick up on that and really shift their mode into that dialogue mentality, even if it's something they've never done before. It's a very, in a healthy way, it's very seductive, in that it really seduces us into trying to find that sense of intimacy and understanding that comes when we really are getting to know someone else in a good way.
So I think a lot of people look at dialogue as a means to an end. And when they have a dialogue, they're looking for measurable outcomes. How do you feel about that view of dialogue?
Fine. I think dialogue can lead to excellent outcomes. I've been involved in many conversations that have led to, first through understanding, then to common purpose, and finally to policy. Dialogue can just be about getting to know each other's points of view. It can just be about deepening your understanding of another perspective. But many dialogues are more generative in the sense of, at the end, hoping to have some positive outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great use of dialogue. It doesn't have to be just about the talk. It can be about the subsequent action.
Mm-hmm. In those cases, one would have an agenda.
Well, the agenda is to come up with a good solution. The agenda is, we have a lot of interesting people in this room that have come from really different backgrounds. And many of us have a very different ideas about what to do about this particular issue. But let's start by really trying to understand each other's point of view, why we think we should go this way rather than that way. What is it in our own backgrounds, our own histories,
mm-hmm.
that informs how we think about this issue? Once we have that out on the table, let's see if we can come to some consensus about what's a good way forward in which everybody will feel like we've created a positive outcome. And that's a very functional component of dialogue that is perhaps underrated.
That reminds me of the intro to Deep Democracy that I experienced with the semester in dialogue, led by our very own Aftab Arfan, where we looked at the iceberg model or framework, and we saw how, well, as we know, the iceberg model has to do with what is above the waterline, what is conscious, what is known, what can be seen, and what is unconscious or hidden. And the idea was, to really reach someone and deepen your connection, one needs to lower the waterline. I think that when we're coming together in dialogue with that intention of hearing all of the diverse voices, that can be very challenging. The deep democracy approach is really about bringing everybody along, despite the fact that we have some differing ideas or differing opinions. But at the same time, as you mentioned, recognizing that lived experience and those places within us that inform our beliefs and our ideas and our thoughts towards the same topic. So definitely interested in how deep democracy plays out in our center's work, maybe now and in the future. But just going back to, you know, a means to an end for dialogue and how we get there. That's one of the most important questions that we would want to ask you, is how do we actually create a dialogue? What are the ingredients or conditions necessary for a good dialogue to happen?
Well, first you need something to talk about, a subject. You need a group of people that are willing to come together, whatever their opinions, and listen to the opinions of others. It helps to have good facilitation, good modeling for how you listen. It helps to be really inclusive. One of the things that happens in almost any room, the group of people talking, is that there's a power dynamic. There may be some people in the room that have important titles, or they come from wealth, and they are used to having power. And there may be people in the room that don't have those things. I try to start conversation, you know, in a dialogue, I try to start with the people that have the least power and make sure that they get to be heard first, because that sets a tone. Both, we get to hear what they have to say, which we might not otherwise, but it also sets a tone of everybody in the room is equal. And create that sense of equality, both, you know, in who's invited, but in particularly in how everybody is respected, is a, you know, critical aspect of setting the tone for dialogue. We often evolve guidelines together for how we want to be together in the room.
Mm.
How to be civil, how to be respectful, how to be honest, how to not be personal in terms of, you know, attack. In presenting your point of view, not assuming you understand the point of view of others before you've heard from them, in avoiding stereotypes. So, you know, all those things come together in a way that is essential to setting a tone where people can go deeper in their interactions with each other than we normally do.
I'm thinking of your time with the Semester in Dialogue program. I'm sure you've had so many amazing experiences leading that class, cohort after cohort, year after year. In terms of that kind of setting the stage and the expectations and laying that groundwork for, you know, respectful dialogue, how can you tell us a little bit about how you engage the students to shed the stereotypes that they had of one another or of topics? How do you...
Well, a typical exercise that we've done with students is to go around the room and ask them about things that they hold as stereotypes. You know, some of them will say things like, I think anybody who works for a corporation is evil. Or somebody else will come up with a stereotype about a particular culture or religion. And so first we understand that we all walk into the room with a stereotype and a history and a bias. So that's one of the exercises we've done. The you know, the dialogue classroom, Semester in Dialogue, it feels so different than almost any classroom I've ever been in. There's so many elements that make it that way, and I'm trying to think of what is it that creates that magic sauce. And one of the things is, as a teacher, I really consider myself more of a facilitator than a teacher. And I am genuinely curious about the backgrounds and histories and points of view of each of the students. I think that sense of genuine curiosity about others is really critical too, because then, you know, then everybody feels like, you know, this isn't fake. This is real. Like we really are interested in each other, because A, we can learn about each other, we can learn about issues, but, you know, we can develop a sense of caring about each other as we, and so creating that caring, supportive, you know, we may differ about some things, but ultimately we're here for communal success. That's a pretty important part in a classroom, which tends to be very hierarchical, where, you know, the person who gets the A plus is at the top and the person who gets the lowest grade is at the bottom. And we try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. You taught in the semester in dialogue, as you've just shared with us, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the place of dialogue in the classroom and the value of dialogue for young students, both in the semester in dialogue and in all other classrooms.
The approach we take in the semester in dialogue is the most deeply transformative educational experience that I've ever seen. And I've been around universities pretty much my whole adult life. In fact, I was a terrible student. I, you know, had a 2.4 grade point average when I graduated, I think, as an undergraduate, because I was just completely bored of sitting in a classroom and hearing some usually older male professors just get up there and yak, yak, yak about something. It was very non-interactive. And I think that model of teaching, which I've done, you know, I've gotten in front of classes and I've lectured, but the more of that kind of work I did, the less interested I was in that one-way exposition of me talking, them taking down their notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created a different model that was based, I'd say, on three pillars. Experiential learning, where students do rather than just sit there and listen. It's very active. Community engagement, where the idea is that at some point during the semester, actually a number of points, the students are going to do something in the community that is beneficial for the community, not just for the students. And the last part is dialogue, using this mechanism of interaction and deeper dive understanding that dialogue can bring. And those things came together supported by really frequent debriefing, where we do something, we reflect on what we did and why it worked or didn't work, and then we go back and do it again. And a lot of very intense one-on-one mentoring where students could come in and talk to me or other faculty about what they wanted to do with their lives and how they saw themselves in the context of what they wanted to do in the world. And so you put all those elements together and it's really magic. I'd say almost every student who came out of the semester was in a positive way changed. They were more deeply committed to civic
engagement.
They were more civil. They were way more interested in listening. Often their personal lives really change too. They might break up with a partner or affirm that this was the right person for them. They often change groups of friends. They might no longer be interested in the shallow conversation friends, but now want friends in which they could do more meaningful things. Certainly professionally, they often completely changed what they thought they wanted to do with their lives. You know, coming in expecting to be a doctor and leaving being an environmental sustainability expert, or coming in expecting to be a scientist and leaving as an artist. So many different, each student had, you know, would tell you a different part of themselves that really grew and matured. I often thought of it as inflation, in the sense of inflating to your full self. You know, finally bringing who you were in every sense of the word into the classroom. Not just the person who sits there taking notes and takes a test, but the person who may have some thing they want to do in the world that makes it a little bit better. And I think that sense of inflating to your full self you were meant to be is a just absolutely powerful outcome of this kind of teaching. I shouldn't say this kind of teaching. I would say this kind of learning, because we quickly stop using words like teaching, because that's really not how faculty would see themselves. We saw ourselves, as did the students, as on this great learning adventure.
I couldn't agree more. I can only imagine that the learning was a two-way endeavor in the classroom. Could you tell us about any student experiences that you learned from?
Oh, so many. One student comes to mind, very first semester in dialogue was about, it's called Nature, Environment, and Society. And because I'm a writer, I always imagined that the final project for the students would be to write a 3,000-word piece to submit to a major magazine. And one student came in, and she literally came in, sat down, and started crying. She said, you know, she was an A-plus student in molecular biology, you know, fast track in the top of the science world. And she said, I actually don't want to be a scientist. I want to be an artist. And she told me for her final project, she wanted to do a painting. And that just blew my conceptions of what students might do out of the water completely. Like a painting, like, I don't know anything about painting. But I said yes, and she did a marvelous painting about, from a feminist point of view, about Gaia and the environmental crisis. It was a beautiful painting, and it was interesting because she started out very angry. And by the end of the painting, she'd become much more understanding of some of the positive aspects of how she might view the environment. And for probably for 10, 15 years, we hung her painting in our classroom because it reminded me never to diminish what students can do. I thought all they could do is write a paper because that's what they were used to. But she wanted to do a painting. And it blew out of the water my whole conceptions of these final projects. We had students do one-person theater shows. We had students do film and video. We had one student that did a guerrilla theater experience where at 2 a.m, she got a whole bunch of students and friends in a parking garage, and looking across the way was another parking garage. And at 2 a.m. in that other parking garage, she'd arranged for a truck to come with sod, and she put sod down, and that was her project. I thought that was so cool. You know, it just really helped me to understand how much capacity students have to do really interesting, impactful things that we just never give them the opportunity to do. So I'd say that was one really substantive change in how I viewed my professional world, as in that sense of really opening up to giving students a chance to express themselves in the ways that they could be most effective.
That painting concept as a final project reminds me of Manabu Ikeda, who is a Japanese artist, internationally acclaimed, and he had an exhibit at the Audain Art Museum out in Whistler, and his paintings, multiple paintings, looked like multi-page theses on the wall. They were he talks about climate change and social impacts and the future as we know it or don't. He's really quite talented and extremely detailed in his paintings, but certainly more than just what you see on the wall. I'm sure he has a lot more to say.
Well, our students did do a lot of writing, which is an area that I could particularly help them with. And, you know, in a class of 20 students, every semester, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 of them would publish an opinion piece in a major Canadian newspaper or magazine. You know, the Vancouver Sun, the Globe and Mail, the National Post, Chatelaine, I mean, they publish all over the place. And you just never think that, you know, faculty don't do that. You know, it's very rare for a faculty member to publish an op-ed piece, and to have, you know, a quarter or a third of the students in an undergraduate class get published in a major newspaper also told me a lot about how we underestimate students' capacity. But it also was a great experience in understanding learning and how when you give students deeper input than we usually are able to give, they're able to produce remarkable work. And none of these students ever would have thought they could publish in a major newspaper before. And so the learning there for me was, again, just don't underestimate what people can do when you give them the right support.
Absolutely. I remember SFU looking into creating an experiential learning inventory. So I think there were, I was also involved in a project looking at how many sort of work integrated learning opportunities or community engaged opportunities experiential learning opportunities that students have within coursework. And so the onus is on the instructor to embed that into their curriculum and into their pedagogy.
Well, that experiential learning inventory was the work of two of our students.
Is that right?
Yeah, they really got interested in experiential learning. And when they graduated, they went to the vice president academic and they said, experiential learning just changed our lives. And we'd like to help foster that at the university. And maybe the first step is to find out what's being done and how's it being done and what kind of impact it's having. Mm-hmm. And he hired both of them for a year or two as a job. And they did a fantastic job of documenting the range and array of experiential learning projects that were going on around SFU. And you know, those two students before the semester in dialogue, mm-hmm. I don't think they ever would have had the confidence to go to the vice president and say, we want to do this. That was mm-hmm. the other, you know, another thing about the semester in dialogue is they accomplished these amazing things and it makes them realize, you know what? You know, I may be a student, but I can really do stuff. Mm-hmm. And gives them the confidence and the skills to go ahead and do that.
Mm-hmm. Talk about transformative. Mark, it's been so nice chatting with you. I'm sure we could talk a little bit more. Are there any final thoughts or words of wisdom you'd like to leave us with as we wrap up for today's conversation?
I guess at the beginning we were starting with the bees.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would come back to the bees and think about... my most recent book is called Listening to the Bees, and it was co-written with a poet, Renee Saklekar. And my experience, I never would have thought of co-writing a book with a poet mm-hmm. if I hadn't spent 20 years downtown at the Center for Dialogue. It has dramatically, remarkably, and positively changed my life in so many good ways. And I've met so many interesting people, and I've had the opportunity to dialogue with so many interesting people to really get to the nuggets of who people are and why they do what they do, and it has left me optimistic. You know, intellectually I look around at the state of the world and I think we're all hooped, like so many problems. I don't know how we're going to get out of this all. And then I sit down with someone and I get to know them and I hear who they are and what they dream about. And I just think we got to keep trying because there's so much good in us. There's so much meaningful in us. There's so much depth in us once we sit down and just get to know each other through dialogue.
I wanted to ask you, Mark, what do you think of the word serendipity these days?
Serendipity?
Mm-hmm. And does that have any feature in your experiences with dialogue?
It's kind of like, it's very much like luck. People say, oh, you were lucky. But I don't believe in serendipity and luck in and of themselves. I think they happen when you pay attention, mm-hmm. when you have curiosity, when you're the kind of person who is listening rather than just letting the world whiz by and judging it. Serendipity is going on around us all the time. It's paying attention to what's happening and noticing it. That leads us to recognize something as luck or serendipity rather than it just blowing past us and missing it. So yeah, there's things that happen all the time that if we notice them, they change our lives. Mm-hmm. And if we don't notice them, then we're gonna just keep going on in whatever pathway we're on already. I think I keep coming back to curiosity mm-hmm. and genuine curiosity. Not curiosity in the hope of affirming what you already think, but curiosity in finding out something you don't already know.
Well, thanks, Mark, for being with us today. This has been such a wonderful pleasure for me to get to know you a little bit better and to confirm a lot of my thinking about what I've heard about you.
I'm not sure what you've heard about me, but enjoyable for you as it has been for me.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to the next one.
Thank you for listening to Talk Dialogue to Me, produced by SFU's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue. You can find out more about us at sfu.ca/dialogue and follow our podcast for more inspiring conversations as we continue to explore all the incredible things dialogue can do.